I'm Alexis Dion.
And I'm Chelsea.
And we're the co-hosts of High Priority, a podcast where we ask industry experts the tough questions about the past, present, and future of the cannabis industry. All right, we are back in full effect with another fabulous episode of High Priority. How are you doing, Chelsea?
I'm good. It is Monday morning, and we are coming off of another busy week in cannabis. First week of January was busy. It's a lot.
I know. A lot of catching
up. Bodes well
to
for
do.
The yeah for the rest of the year for the industry, I guess.
Well, you know, I think it was the best thing for us to start off the new year with, you know, interviewing someone that I think we both hold in high regard, Miss Tremaine Wright, chair of New York's Cannabis Control Board and also former New York State Assembly member. I'm really excited for her.
Yeah, Alexis, huge ups to you, PR queen, for landing that interview. I mean, like, I don't want to say we're peaking now, but this is a pretty big milestone in the High Priority interview lineup, wouldn't you say?
I definitely agree. I mean, just the loops that I had to go through to get her on the show, going through her sister and then going through various other assistants just to get in contact with
Alexis
her.
Alexis knows what she's doing.
I'm a great stalker, guys. So, yeah, I'm really excited to have Tremaine on the show. I really want to kind of get into what she sees the future looking like for New York in terms of recreational use of cannabis. Obviously, we have a medical program here, so that's been around for a few years. But I'm really intrigued to get her perspective on what's the forecast going to be for New York in terms of adult use, and specifically if we're going to have some really good social equity programs in place, because, you know, we've heard in the past with other states that, you know, they promise that they're going to have certain things lined up for social equity applicants, and it just doesn't happen that way. And this is going to be a really huge market. I mean, according to Headset, which is one of our amazing clients, they project that New York rec sales alone, so not even medical, we're just talking about recreational use alone, the sales are projected to hit, in its first year, $1.1 billion.
Nice.
I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, especially since, you know, we're not just talking about New York City. New York, I think a lot of people forget, New York is a very big state. It, like, goes all the way up to Canada. Like, there are so many opportunities, not just in retail, but in really every facet, like tech, cultivation, manufacturing. And I think there are 9 licenses that New York State is going to put out in the next year or so. And the goal, hopefully, is to also include real New Yorkers, people of color, impacted of communities, and invite them into that conversation and that business community.
Yes, for sure. And for those who don't know, rec use in New York was officially legalized last year on March 31st via what they call the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, people also abbreviated as MRTA. So if you hear us speaking a lot about MRTA, just want you to know what that is.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that while we were developing these questions, so many of these themes and topics came from the business owners that we've interviewed previously, right? You know, and a lot of these people have gone through the licensing process in other states, or they are business owners, and they have come up against obstacles that they weren't expecting and that the state didn't know what to do about, and maybe the state wrote those regulations with the best intentions, but you know, implementation is always very different when it, you know, it comes to actually seeing how it rolls out. So given those insights, we also hope to, you know, get some perspective on Chair Wright about some of the things that haven't really worked out in other states, and hopefully plant a seed in her head to make sure that doesn't happen in New York.
Agreed. Especially because New York is full of immigrants, full of black and brown people. We really want to make sure that the people who are mostly impacted by the war on drugs get a chance to really be a part of this industry and, you know, create another stream of income for themselves and their families.
Yeah. And cannabis prohibition is a really, you know, dark part of New York's history, too. You know, stop and frisk was a very, you know, sad and awful part of law enforcement. And it, you know, I think at some point New York was named like the cannabis like arrest capital of the world.
Insane.
So these are all things that we have to keep in mind, and hopefully Chair Wright and her her team is keeping in mind while they're implementing and developing these regulations.
That's a really good point, Chelsea. And I also just want to bring to the forefront that women have been leading this movement for New York. Shout out to Senator Liz Krueger and Assemblyperson mm-hmm. Crystal Peoples Stokes, because they were the one that introduced the MRTA or MRTA Act that allowed, you know, New York to legalize rec use of cannabis. So shout out to them. And then you have Ms. Tremaine Wright, who's the head of the New York Cannabis Control Board. So shout out to all the women who are really trying to push this movement forward.
That's right. Yeah, we couldn't do it without women who actually care and are going to do something about problems.
Once again.
Once again, women coming to the forefront to save all of your asses.
So let us just go ahead and jump right in, and let's talk to Chair Tremaine Wright, the chair of New York's Cannabis Control Board. So welcome, Chair Wright. Thank you for taking time to share what your team at the Cannabis Control Board is up to with the high priority community. In previous statements, you've said that cannabis prohibition denies the lived experiences of our friends and families. Well, as a native Brooklynite and a former assembly member, how has the war on drugs impacted your own community? And how will you use these insights to shape New York's cannabis laws?
Well, thank you very much for having me here at the High Priority Community. I am most thankful for the opportunity to come in to speak with you today about cannabis in New York State. So thank you first and foremost. And I would say your question hits the nail right on the head. It is, I would say the war on drugs has definitively shaped my experience here in New York. Mm-hmm. I am born and bred in New York. I have grown up in a space where people were subjected to being over-surveilled, where they had police interactions, where there was fear amongst many of the young people I grew up with because of the police. And it sort of erases the age of innocence for many of our young people. So when I say it denies lived experiences, it's because it denies us the opportunity to live fully. It denies us opportunity to really embrace what it is to be 14, 15, and 16 living in New York City. A space that should be filled with opportunity was a space that was filled with fear and terror and trauma. And so when I think about what the war on drugs looked like for me growing up, it looked like knowing that friends that went to play basketball were picked up in sweeps on any random Friday. And they may have spent hours, if not a day, sitting in police stations. It's people who lived in fear of interactions and that they were always bracing the young people in their lives for what to do to prevent the worst versus giving them the opportunity to explore freely. So I think those insights, those experiences are definitively a part of my conversation when I come to cannabis and what it's going to mean for our community. And I believe that they will help us in shaping the laws and the regulations. I was very happy to sit in the assembly and to be a part of the negotiation of the MRTA. And also, I look forward to being a part of development of these regulations so that we can make sure that the way in which it plays out and is implemented is really going to speak to all of New Yorkers and allow us an opportunity to participate.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chair Wright, Alexis and I are very honored to have you join us on our podcast as well. And I think a lot of people in New York are excited to see you at the helm of the Cannabis Control Board. So as the chair, you and your associates are responsible for developing and implementing the state's forthcoming cannabis rules and regulations. What specific criteria were you and the governor's office looking for in potential CCB members? And what strengths or perspectives do each of the five members bring to the table?
So the members of the Cannabis Control Board were selected by the governor, the New York State Senate, and the New York State Assembly. And I believe that the three units have come together to create a body of people who speak to small business, who understand equity, who know that the environment and the impact that industry has on our communities is really important, that understand that unionized work has sustained and strengthened New Yorkers for centuries. And it's a strong understanding of government, how it operates, and how we can really utilize it to make things better. So I think that that's what had been identified by in each of the members, and that they've assembled a group that really is bringing all of those strengths to the table and then is going to keep us focused on the real goals of making sure that this is an industry where people can enter, innovate, where research is going to lead us into new spaces, and that we can pipeline people into opportunity. So I think that that's what they were looking for, and I think that it was spot on.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And when I was doing research for this episode, I noticed that I think like 4 out of 5 of the members are people of color, which is really encouraging because not a lot of states have done that.
It is. And I think that it's also reflective of the fact that that's who lives in New York State, that these are people who are qualified, that these are people who have resumes as long as our arm, and they've done so many interesting things from issuing bonds and creating funds to running law firms or being union organizers, people that have sat and that have worked in energy and in environment, that work on policy. I think that this is a reflection of New York, and I'm glad that we're together.
I love that. And I'm glad that you're on here as a woman of color advocating for the people that you have on your board. And since we're talking about how progressive this whole process is, based on the language outlined in the MRTA, New York is poised to roll out one of the most progressive and equitable regulatory frameworks in the country. And of course, many regulated and legacy industry stakeholders are concerned about New York's ability to follow through on these commitments based on how other states have dropped the ball. One of the main points of contention is the application scoring process. Even in New Jersey, which just came online, some social equity applications claim that their applications have been unfairly scored. This begs the question, who will score New York's applications? And what measures will your team take to ensure balanced and accessible evaluations?
So New York we are paying attention to what's going on in all of the other states. We are concerned where there are points of contention in the scoring process, that there are concerns by those applicants as well as the states in creating a system that people can believe in, that they know and understand. So we are guiding ourselves in that direction, and we're trying to come up with a system that acknowledges that it's not always as cut and dry, that understanding the full scope of a person's business vision, that of their history, of the strengths that they bring to a new business, because we're talking about new businesses in a lot of these instances. So people don't have track records for us to lean on. This is really about people being able to express thoughts, opportunities. And so we need to figure out what that system looks like, but it also has to be reliable, because you ask who's going to be doing this measuring and who's making the assessments. Like every other agency, we have a team of people who aren't even all hired yet that will have to review applications. Mm-hmm. And we also have created a legal response, a legal team that will hold administrative hearings for when there are concerns on how a application has been evaluated. And so we're trying to build into the system, one, equity and understanding and fairness, something that people can believe in, but we're also trying to make sure that we have ensured ways for people to come back and rebut a decision and to have another oversight. After our team reviews them, we receive the recommendation on how to rule on a particular application will be presented to the board. The board has the ability to review in further detail any of these applications so that we can have sort of, I'm going to say, our second set of eyes, or if it's gone before the administrative judge, the third set. So we're trying to build a system that people can understand, but that also makes sense for everyone and also provides people with the opportunity to come back and address any concerns that they have in a fair and equitable manner.
That's awesome. It seems like there are some checks and balances put in place to prevent the issues that we've seen in other states.
I was going to say, New York. Agency work is, it's a lot. And I think that we sometimes forget how much work people in government are actually tasked with doing and sure. to achieve. So they will be going through lots and lots of applications. And I think that we want to always create something that is restricted enough so that we know that there's not too much discretion, because personal discretion has the problem. We know that the problems that can appear if one person is reviewing applications one way and another is reviewing another in a different manner. We've got to have some uniformity. And so we want to make sure that we have those guardrails in place, but we need to leave enough space so that we can really know and understand even something as simple as how are people qualifying as social equity will become one of the conversation points later on. And we've got to have something that actually speaks to people, makes sense, and that people have faith in.
Yeah, yeah, it's great to hear that your team is taking a very thorough approach and looking at what other states are doing. And like Alexis said, implementing those checks and balances. So I really hope that that's what New Yorkers gain confidence in down the line. Another notable aspect of the MRTA is the state's commitment to allocating 40% of tax revenues to the Community Grants Reinvestment Fund to benefit communities impacted by the war on drugs. However, given the fact that New York was once known as the marijuana arrest capital of the world, how will the CCB determine what neighborhoods or communities should receive these reinvestment funds?
So I'm very proud of the work that we've done with the MRTA and that the state has committed 40% of the tax revenues for community grants and the reinvestment. I think this is exactly what we're supposed to be doing with the tax dollars related to cannabis. However, the Office of Cannabis Management and the Cannabis Control Board will not have a voice in that process. That work will be handled by the advisory board. And the advisory board is comprised of 15 people, again, appointed by the governor, the Senate, and the New York State Assembly. Those people will be responsible for determining the grants that will be awarded, the communities that will receive them, and in what order. OCM will simply provide them support resources so for the administration of the fund, but we will not be making the decisions. I think that's going to be a hard one. I think there are lots of communities and extremely talented people in New York who can come up with great visions of how we might want to make investments in community. And so I think that that advisory board is going to be tasked with the hard job of figuring out who gets the first or the second or is 10th in line for one of these grants.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. If in an ideal world you had some kind of say in where that money was allocated, what kind of local programs or services do you believe some of this money should go toward?
Wow. I want to say right now, so many people in New York are really burdened with housing. I would love to see a project that's using some of the cannabis building materials, so hemp building materials, building housing for people that is actually affordable and that they could use, but those kind, and they would put so many people to work. Like, I would love to see projects where the impact is multi-layered, so that we're seeing investment, we're seeing opportunities for growth and skill building, but we're also filling a need that is going to have long-term impact. So to me, something like housing going up, made out of housing that's built on hemp products, would be fantastic. I think that those are, that would be one of those kind of projects that would speak to a lot of people, and it fills a need that exists here in New York State.
Yeah, love that.
That would be cool.
Great vision.
I would be on board with that.
Yeah, New Yorkers are always hemp.
We have hemp growers already in New York State,
right.
So it's not, we wouldn't have to wait on it. It would be something that would probably be easily achieved. I'm very excited for what they can do.
Absolutely.
But these really have to be community-driven projects for them to be effective. Because while I'm saying that, I live in New Brooklyn. So it's a, you know, I don't want to be making the decisions across the board. I just think that there's, I really want to hear the voice of the people from the ground up.
Understandable. And as someone who also lives in Brooklyn, specifically Crown Heights, on my side of Crown Heights, there are a lot of people out here who are looking for jobs. So it would be nice to, you know, have those people get into the business and start being able to take care of themselves and their families. So just personal feeling on that. Also, cannabis has been promoted as a way for BIPOC entrepreneurs to build generational wealth. However, access to capital and professional networks remains a tremendous barrier to entry. What measures will the Cannabis Control Board take to ensure that entrepreneurs of color can access vital banking and fundraising platforms that are not predatory, especially considering how SAFE banking has been tabled again by Congress?
So I'm extremely happy to announce and to share with the listeners today that just today on January 5th, Governor Hochul announced, she didn't say it during the State of the State, but it is in the book, that we are going to have a fund for social equity participants in the cannabis market. It is estimated that we are trying to raise $200 million, $50 million from taxes and licensing fees, and approximately $150 million from private investors. So we are doing this in conjunction with DASNY, one of our board members. We were talking about the talents that come together on a board, and we are being led by Ruben McDaniel, who sits on our board, but is also the president of the Dormitory Authority for the State of New York. He's leading the charge and helping us to structure a fund so that we will have monies available to provide loans, hopefully low interest and or zero interest loans to participants, particularly social equity participants in the cannabis industry.
That's wonderful. Wow. I feel so like honored that High Priority got to get this
information.
Like, it's amazing. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. I think it's great that New York is thinking about solutions to the problem instead of, you know, putting that burden on business owners who already have so much to deal with.
But I am also going to say, I want to challenge people to look at the resources around them. I know very often we keep hearing, the money's not here. Monies are here in our communities. And very often we've seen informal savings, lending solutions. Very often people like refer to like susus. People have used informal lending systems. And there are a lot of platforms that are currently available for our budding entrepreneurs to go on to raise funds. And I don't want to call any by name, but there are a number of them online where people can get investors and they can structure it however it needs to be. If it's true investment, like buying of a share, if it's convertible loans, and people do it with small dollar amounts. I want to say one platform, you have to make $100 investment, but there are companies that are raising, you know, $250,000 through folks who can contribute as little as $100. So we have abilities and we do have resources in our community. I think we just also have to be conscious to tap into them. And I hope that the entrepreneurial spirit allows people to explore what that looks like.
Yeah,
because they don't need big money coming from outside all the time. Sometimes it's enough right here.
Yeah, I do love that idea of New York businesses being fully funded by New Yorkers. That would be lovely. You're wrong. Only New York could do it, so might as well. Yeah, and we're seeing in more mature adult use markets, you know, these social equity licensees often lose out on potential business opportunities because regulations that may have initially been written with, you know, the best of intentions end up hurting them in the long run. We've seen this in California, where social equity licensees can't sell their businesses and exit, and in Massachusetts, where private businesses couldn't put capital in their incubator partners. Considering this history, how will New York's licensing structure allow social equity businesses to appropriately scale and pivot in this highly competitive market, especially considering how, you know, many of these applicants are going after micro licenses?
So in New York, we only offer the what I'm going to refer to as micro licenses, because we are definitively working against a monopoly structure. So we have 9 license types, and we are encouraging people to obtain whichever makes sense for their business and whatever would grow their current businesses and or help them enter into a new part of the business. So there will be micro businesses and cooperatives as well, but we have 9 license types. We want to make sure that our social equity licensees are not flipping licenses, because we do not want to create a secondary market for licenses. So we also prohibit the sale of the license within 3 years. But sale does not mean that you can't put capital into your business or borrow money or get investors. It means that you have to own your license. So what I'm also going to say is that part of the work that we're going to be doing throughout incubate, I don't want to say incubate, but through some of the incubators, some of our technical services, is we will be helping people to structure deals, loans, and agreements for investment in ways that actually empower them, allow them to keep control of their businesses and to grow and scale their businesses. Because part of our work here for OCM and the CCB is that we've got to create an industry that's healthy, and that health does not come from our smaller licensees being crippled and unable to grow their business. But we also have to be mindful that we're not creating secondary markets for those licenses. We want to make sure that people who are defined as equity licensees participate in the market. And if they are not going to utilize that opportunity, that they pass that opportunity on to another social equity applicant. So that's what our restriction is. If they don't want to be in the market, go ahead, sell it to another social equity applicant, but you may not flip it out to a large investor coming in from out of state. And that's what we're really trying to prohibit, but we're trying to build in mechanisms so that we can help people to scale their businesses. Because our interest is not in keeping social equity businesses tiny and small. We want them to be able to grow and prosper like everyone else.
Amen to that. I love hearing that because on our podcast, like, we are very much social equity focused, and we want to make sure that a lot of these social equity businesses have a chance to really thrive and grow. So thank you for sharing that. As of this recording, about 400, or roughly a quarter, of New York's municipalities have already opted out of legal cannabis businesses. As we've seen in California, high opt-out rates bolster legacy market sales and often undermine public safety and the regulated market. So how will your office proactively address this issue and expand cannabis access and business opportunities in areas that have opted out?
So the 400 municipalities that have opted out have only opted out of dispensary and consumption spaces. Marijuana remains legal throughout this state, and marijuana and or cannabis businesses can operate in every single municipality in our state. We are working diligently to make sure that people do not have to travel far in order to obtain or access a dispensary or consumption space in our state. So I know that it sounds like a lot when we hear that there are 400 opt-outs, but the opt-out might be the town, but the village within the town did not opt out. So within the town, the village will still have the ability to host a dispensary and or a consumption space. So it sounds like it's going to be, I know that it is work for us. I'm not trying to pretend that this is an easy lift, but now that we have all of that information, because December 31st was their cutoff date to opt out, now we can begin to plot where spaces are available and where we're able to actually issue licenses. And so that was part of the work that we needed to hear from them so that we know what our work will look like. So that as in planning what it looks like for our state to have access across the state, now we know what that plan looks like. But I want to just reiterate, it is legal throughout our state for folks to utilize cannabis and to operate cannabis businesses, even in those municipalities that have chosen to opt out of dispensaries or consumption spaces.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify the dispensary and consumption space opt-out situation, does that mean a company could technically cultivate in that city? Okay.
So they could cultivate, manufacture, process, hold a distribute. That could be their distribution center. Mm-hmm. They operate out of nurseries. All of that can occur in those spaces. So I like for people to think about it this way. There's a neighborhood in Brooklyn that doesn't have any bars, which I think would surprise people. Like the Brownsville section of Brooklyn has no bars. They've opted not to have on-site consumption. It goes through their community. Wow. I was so surprised when I learned this. And I was like, are you for real? And they were like, yeah, we don't do that. And I was like, oh, wow. So, right. It's interesting. And we're like, oh, okay. But it doesn't stop liquor or bars or anything else from occurring in our city or from people being able to access a bar because it's enough proximity that they can go into another community board and actually get what they want. And so that's what we're trying to make sure happens throughout our state when we talk about cannabis. We want people to be surprised almost like, oh, they don't have any? I didn't even think about it because there's proximity and that there's access. And that's what we're working towards.
I see. Yeah, that's also a great message to send for any listeners / aspiring entrepreneurs who were discouraged by that 400 number. There are still many options on the table, it looks like. So luckily, individuals with prior cannabis records under, the MRTA, their records should, in theory, be automatically expunged, and they should be able to work in the regulated industry if they so choose. Of course, this legal process is easier said than done with when, oftentimes records are misplaced or lost. So how is New York's legal system preparing to efficiently process this influx of expungement requests?
So the wonderful thing about the New York expungement process is that we started in 2019 when we passed the decrim bill. That bill was the first step in sealing records. And I guess the 2019 process, we got to about 200, almost 200, maybe a little more than 200,000 people. When we passed MRTA, we have since then added an additional 200,000 people for whom we have either sealed or suppressed their records. The Office of Court Administration is currently in the process of expunging records. And so New Yorkers don't actually have to do anything. They don't need to request it. They don't have to ask for it. The one thing I will advise them to do is to check the status and to know where they are in the process. If they wanted to just make sure that their record wasn't popping up, they can go to the courthouse and they can do that. If they need any assistance, I need them to go to the Office of Court Administration's website, which I believe is nyscourts.gov. and they should be able to get, there is an expungement page, and they'll get a full understanding of what the process has been thus far, where they might be in the process, and how we can move forward. We had about 45 people in New York State that were active. They were incarcerated and had marijuana charges when we passed the MRTA. We have gone back, reviewed their cases, and removed all of the marijuana related charges. I think there were 11 people who were ultimately released as a result of that. There are 34 who remain in jail, but their charges are not at all related to the marijuana possession. Okay. So we're trying to be very proactive on our end so people don't have to do anything. And I would say that that was one of the leading impetuses behind folks getting behind legalization, and the work that we were doing is that they knew that we were going to be making sure that we repaired the harm that had been done mm-hmm. to people who were operating or somehow caught up in the over-policing of cannabis in our country. We wanted to make sure that New York tried to right some of those wrongs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important
yeah,
for us to hear.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned that really this automatic expungement process is just taking off. Do you have a sense of when, you know, all of these legal offices will be done processing the outstanding cases?
So let me say our most recent update from the Office of Court Administration was approximately 2 months ago. And that was when we got the numbers that gave us 400,000 people who have been impacted thus far. And they seem to be on a pretty rigorous schedule. They believe the expungements are coming, like in the coming months, but they did not give us a firm date. So I'm going to say it's probably in the near future that these records will be expunged. But I want people to follow up on it, especially if they have been prohibited from any accessing any benefits or opportunities because of it. I definitely want them to go in and check on the status. Even today, the governor announced that TAP, our tuition assistance program, is going to be extended to people who had formerly incarcerated and part-time students. And I know that that's also a hurdle for people. So we're really trying to make a way for New Yorkers who had been unnecessarily incarcerated, or I should say unfairly incarcerated, to really regain their footing and to have an opportunity to fully participate in society. So these are just some of the mechanisms, but I do want them to hold us accountable and check in on it and make sure the work is being done.
That's great. I love to hear that. And I'm hoping that other states will look to New York in terms of how you guys are really trying to rectify the impact of the war on drugs. So very thankful to hear that.
Yeah, it's very encouraging to also hear about how New York is thinking about reentry in this whole process, too, because people need to gain skills and go back to school after prison. So this is very important.
Yes. I was going to say the moment of release when someone leaves prison or a jail and they're trying to make transition back into society, I think that it's re-socialization. And there's new responsibilities. That's sometimes a very new world, depending on how long someone's been incarcerated. So the supports that we as a state put in place at this moment, I hope that we are not just, I hope that we continue to move further along so that we understand how much support is necessary for people to make that transition in the moment, because it is bigger, it's broader. And I know that's outside the scope of cannabis, but I do think that our state is moving in that direction and that work was happening in tandem with the conversation on cannabis legalization.
For sure. And since we are on the topic of transitioning, we all know that there are a lot of legacy operators out there who are currently online in New York, and they are eager to be a part of the regulated market. So what licensing opportunities, if there are any, will be most accessible to them?
So our legacy operators are probably really well positioned to determine exactly how they want to participate in this market and what makes the most sense for them financially as well as professionally. So they have the opportunity, of experience. And I want to make sure that they know and understand that they have every license available under New York State to participate. We are not limiting them in any way, and I don't want them to limit themselves. I would like for them to participate in every aspect of the business. So for them to select what makes sense, whichever licensing does, and for them to go after it. Some of them will qualify as social equity licensees. Some of them are so advanced that they probably don't need us in the same way. They really just need a good application that allows them to get it. So we are aware that there are some concerns for legacy operators and or anybody operating outside of regulated markets and or people who don't pay taxes. So we're trying to think about what information we ask for on our applications so that we're not creating additional layers of exposure for people, because we are cognizant that our information could be seen and or used by other agencies, and we do not want to put anyone in harm's way. So we're aware of that, and we are trying to make sure that we ask for information in a way that doesn't create additional hurdles or barriers for people. And so we're trying to do that on our part, but I'm also going to ask legacy operators to be ambitious and to participate fully and to get their applications in, because they are already in the market and they know how business works, and they will help to make sure that this is a thriving economy.
Makes total sense. And since we have touched on the legacy operators, I kind of want to go to the opposite end and talk about the multi-state operators. So since the multi-state operators have relatively more power and resources in every market they operate in, will the Cannabis Control Board hold these multi-state operators that want to enter into New York to any social equity commitments?
So we have not been mandated under the law to hold any licensee to additional responsibilities. But I can say, as an agency, we want good players. We want people who are going to treat folks fairly. That's part of the reason why we have union obligations for our workers, and that we want to see worker protections. We want to see opportunity for people to have ownership in these brands and businesses, and we want to see good partners. So at this point, beyond saying that, we can't commit to any responsibilities that will be placed upon a particular licensee type. But I do also want to say that many of our MSOs are looking for ways to participate in the social equity support system, that they are exploring ways to partner with universities and school and training systems. Many of them are also partnering with smaller businesses and making investments in them. So we want them to be good partners. And I guess that means that we expect them to operate with the highest integrity. And we want them to enter into partnership agreements that empower their partners, not exploit. So those are the kind of things that we're looking for. But I think that we're looking for that across the market. And since they are some of our bigger, stronger participants, we expect them to lead.
Yeah, that's a very, that's a very interesting approach, especially since I would wager many MSOs are eager to come into New York. So for the state to set such a high bar, hopefully that will trickle into other states as well, since many of these operators are in 4 or 5.
Right. They're in almost every state and international. So we really just have to be clear that this is the way we want them. I think that when we approached cannabis in New York State, we were really thinking, how do we allow New Yorkers to participate? How do we create a pathway for young people in New York to grow this industry, to figure out what research needs to be done, what innovations need to be made? And so since that's the lens through which we were working, we have to maintain that as the agency. And so it's okay that larger corporations and businesses operate, they just have to buy into the vision. And so I think it's easier sometimes with our smaller operators to help them get on board and to be a part of that movement. MSOs, like you said, are coming in with experience all over the country and internationally. And so they have to shift a bigger ship. And sometimes that takes a little longer. So right now, hopefully they're being socialized to our goals and they're aligning their missions with it.
Mm. So that response kind of touches on my next question. And we've talked about the rollout in so many different ways and what you hope this market looks like. But in your own words, how would you define a successful rollout? And in an ideal world, what will New York's cannabis market look like in 2 to 5 years?
Wow. The rollout of cannabis in New York. I would love to see that when we are issuing licenses, that we have a market, that we have prepared our market in a way that we're issuing licenses so that we're touching every corner of this state, that every corner has participants, that they have access, that the businesses are robust and that they're growing, and that innovation is coming and it's on its way. So I always think of it as access, growth, and innovation. And so in 5 years, I want to see a market that is fully operational, that we understand we have businesses that have a stronghold in their communities, that they're growing, they're employing people, and that we have innovation occurring that creates new jobs and new opportunities and new utilizations for the plant. So those are sort of the three guiding forces for me. And I think that if we do this properly, New York becomes the biggest market in this country.
Mm. I mean, it's poised to be that, right? Like, we have California as the king or queen of the West Coast. New York will be the king or queen of the East Coast.
And I was going to say, and so much energy is always focused on sort of what's going to happen at the retail store. I really want people to think more broadly. I'm going to say this every time I go out. We have 9 license types. I need people in all areas. I need people growing, cultivating, cloning, coming up with new strains, creating wonderful brands. I need the art that's associated with it. I need mm-hmm. people that are coming up with alternative energy sources to support the industry. I need all of that. And that's what's going to make us great here in New York. And that's what I'm excited about. And when I go out and talk to people and I meet a 20-year-old who's already created an app for delivery in his neighborhood, that excites me. That's what I'm talking about. And I think that's the direction that we're moving in. And I hope that we're able to continue to fund and support those ideas.
I love that. And, you know, this is such a beautiful way to end this amazing interview that we had with you. So thank you, Chair Wright, for coming on. And just so our listeners know where they can find you, and you know, just New Yorkers in general, I know they're going to want to know how to participate in the upcoming legislative process. How can they find you and how can they participate in this process?
So I need everyone to go to cannabis.ny.gov. I need them to sign up for updates. I need them to be on our mailing list. I need them to come back and see us every time we have a board meeting. I promise you, our board meetings are relatively quick and easy. The longest one has been about 35 minutes. We are trying to really find a way to produce information and give it to community so that they walk away empowered and they know what's going on. We need them to be a part of the process. We hope to release regulations in the coming months. Once we release them, they will be in draft form. We will have 2 months of open comment period where I want folks to read them and send us their comments. I need them to tell us what's working, what doesn't work, what potential pitfalls they see in the draft so that we can make corrections and get final copies out the door. Because once that happens, we'll be going rolling right into our licensing period. So I need New Yorkers to be engaged and connected. So again, it's cannabis.ny.gov, and I can't wait to see them.
Wonderful. Perfect. This is great. Thank you so much, Chair Wright.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to High Priority. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Special thanks to Antoine Dry, Donald Edwards, and Jim Pryor from Dirty Soap Entertainment for our intro music. To learn more about our show and parent company, Matteo Communications, head on over to our website at matteo.com. That's M-A-T-T-I-O.com.